Warning. ProTri News is a podcast with different opinions, knowledge and possibly fake news about triathlon racing. This is not for the faint of heart. If you get offended by what is said, please stop listening and go listen to some uplifting meditation music or just go work out and try again. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only and some stories may be dramatized for comedic effect. Enjoy.
Hello, welcome back to another episode of ProTri News. I am your host, Kyle Glass. We have a very special show for you guys. This is the third time Chris Gimmel has been back on the podcast. If you don't know who he is, decorated short course athlete, two-time Olympian, two-time Commonwealth Games. He's now the head of marketing and global at World Triathlon. Third time coming back, Chris. You must love us now at this point.
Yeah, no. Thanks for having me, guys. I'm ready for the bashing. You know, I said, you know, I don't want to avoid the situation. I don't want to avoid any conversation. So I thought, I had a choice of like doing all the pods. You know, they're all lining up, and I thought, okay, well, I give you guys the first option, and then maybe everyone will listen to yours, and then I don't have to do all the other three, and I can get this emotional level at the right from the go.
Well, look, I think we take a moment and just recognize that you still have maybe the most views out of any triathlon video on YouTube. Your sprint with Bevan Doherty at New Plymouth, I still think is in almost approaching 10 million views. So, you know, if anything, we just brought you on for your YouTube celebrity.
Yeah, exactly. Well, imagine if we had TikTok back then, they would have realized that we're not much of an influencer and would have died a slow death, I'm pretty sure. But somehow it survived something. Eminem's the one that we got lucky with, because back in those days there was no music rights and we were able to pinch his song.
Oh, that's right. There you go. That's amazing. Well, look, it's been huge opening weekend of triathlon, right? And we've talked about that 2024 is going to be one of the biggest weekends ever. And really with the opener at WTCS Abu Dhabi came as a huge shock with the cancellation. And so I think what we're going to open with is some questions, and these are the FAQs that we've encountered with, you know, this whole situation of the entire weekend being canceled. So, you know, questions we have are, did Ramadan play a factor? Why couldn't the event be moved to Monday? Was it because of cloud seeding? And so I think we'll just give you the opportunity and the floor to really speak on what was going on behind the scenes on your end and how World Triathlon was trying to navigate this situation. Because for your guys' enterprise, obviously you wanted the weekend to go off without a hitch and the racing to happen.
Yeah. No. And I'll try my best to answer the questions. And look, I'm not here to justify any actions that happened, but like that was the cards that we had to play, and we tried our best to try to do what we could with the situation that was presented to us. And obviously, like, you know, I've heard and passed along in many emails since, you know, asking many questions and heard different views, and that's fine. That's how the world works. Everyone has their own perspective, and we only have the one that we were presented with, so that's what we had to deal with. And the long story short is that everybody knew that there was going to be this massive weather bomb, let's say, coming in to the region, not only in Abu Dhabi, but in that general region through Dubai, Abu Dhabi, and around the coast, around the Gulf Coast. And like that was clear. That was for everyone to see. We could see it. We were monitoring it that whole entire week. We were asking the questions. We were getting the answers that we, of course, wanted to hear. And we were just planning with that process. And in the briefing, we told all the athletes that, like, this is what is going to happen on Friday. This is what is proposed to happen on Saturday. Saturday is looking very suspect for us to not be able to potentially have the events, although at this point in time, we've been told we could have the events. And basically, we went to sleep on the Thursday, thinking that, you know, we'll get up in the morning and we'll see how Friday goes, and then we'll hope the best for Saturday. That's literally what we had. And then I was awoken at 3:45 to a phone call in the morning saying that the races have been cancelled. And I thought to myself, okay, from our head of operations that was already on site. And I thought to myself, okay, great, fantastic. So we already know about Saturday, but at least we can focus our attentions on Friday. And he's like, no, Friday as well. And I'm like, are you kidding me? So we, of course, rushed down to the venue and then started meeting with everyone and started to try to work out what had happened. And let's say we, of course, have contingency plans, and the contingency plan wasn't necessarily followed at that point in time. And why was it not followed? And so you had to sort of find out those answers to those questions before you started pointing fingers and trying to work out how it happened. But as of course has been well documented, the Emergency Crisis Government Agency of the region took a decision to cancel all outdoor and indoor events over the weekend to create this preparation for the weather bomb. And they took that decision on early Friday morning, and that meant everything was cancelled. And so we were then faced with, okay, what can we do? Is there a possibility to find a way to be able to be considered different to every other event? And I'm being, you know, I'm not being candid here, but like to an under 12 gymnastics competition in a hall that was just around the corner was also cancelled, and a fun walk up in the mountains that was 2.5 hours away also cancelled. So like it wasn't just like that they just pointed out at our event and said, right, it's over. It was like every single thing that was happening in the region. And so from then on, we were just troubleshooting and trying to find ways to speak to the right people. And eventually, I think it was about just before the athletes were coming down to the race familiarization, which was happening in the morning, was going to be happening in the morning, sorry, as part of the schedule. We sort of got a glimmer of hope where we had like said, okay, we won't do any broadcast. We won't do anything. We'll just deliver the race behind closed doors. There'll be no photos. There'll be no media. There'll be no nothing. So that we then, like, let's say, would avoid the situation where they would, like, you know, potentially feel adverse that they were, like, making rules for the rest of the community, but we were, like, not following the rules. And then that was, like, a little glimmer of hope. And that sort of, like, unfortunately, if I look back on it now, took it a little bit longer than it maybe needed to be, because we could, of course, had that decision and they said, no, there's absolutely no way. That's not a very good idea. But because we tried to do something, didn't then got taken out a little bit, and then we had to have further calls and further meetings. And most of the people that were involved were not on site. They weren't coming until later in the day. So we were having, like, you know, calls amongst people and was getting translation and so forth. So it just was really, really difficult. And obviously in the end, that proposal, even though we changed the schedule, pushed all the races back, pulled them into the middle. We even had like the para starting at one point in time 10, and we were going to have the females and the males starting at 1 and 3. So we were finished by 5. You know, like originally the last race was going to be at 5, starting at 5. So like we tried to move everything around and get it all in place, but in the end, they just couldn't. They couldn't change the rule that had been passed by the government. And that's a little bit of hang up of COVID and the way that was managed and many, many things, you know, like it's sort of, you know, those precedents almost in place now with these things that like when people don't take things seriously and they don't follow and things go happen, then people become liable for any injuries or any health issues or deaths or whatever. So we just were in, you know, we were just in a unfortunate situation. And as we can see with the world, these things are happening more and more. It's a shame, and we just have to think about that carefully going forward about where we decide to do outdoor events in environments where we can't even feel like we are safe anymore, in a sense we're going to the desert and having a race and getting cancelled for rain.
And then Chris, just walk us through like a really common thing that we've heard is, you know, how come we can't just reschedule the event at a Wollongong, which is a World Cup, or a Waltuco, which is a World Cup and also has a relay. So I think give us some context of like the second and third order effects of, you know, how this isn't just a standalone World Series event. This is a World Series event in the middle of Olympic qualification. So try and just get as macro as you can with everything that happens in that situation.
Sure. I think the first point is, and that's a great way to explain it, but there's even one step back from that. And it was like, okay, can we do this event on Sunday afternoon? Can we do this event on Monday or Tuesday? Mm-hmm. And the reality is like, maybe we could have in that sense, but we didn't. We thought we could do it on Friday as well. And it was not really clear whether the weather warning and everything would be okay again to go on Monday. So what it would have mean is that we would have then had to go and sit down everyone in an emergency meeting with the National Federation and told them, okay, you're all changing your flights. You're all extending a list. You're all going to stay here, which of course, most of them, if you can imagine, they wanted to race. They probably would have been like, okay, yeah, we'll do it. That could be fine. Or some of them would have been like, it's not possible. There's cost implications and so forth to stay here longer and people, you know, flights changing. You can imagine changing 250 flights, blah, blah, blah. So that was like something that maybe was on the table, but like from a common sense perspective, we just didn't even know if it was going to be even possible on Monday and Tuesday based upon the fact that we weren't able to use the contingency plan as a way to decide whether we could or couldn't go forward. And then the second part is that like within this Olympic and Paralympic qualification, there was races every weekend. And Devonport has just obviously just happened down in Australia. And the athletes were on the plane on Sunday and Monday to go there. So if they had to stop and then don't go there and then not be able to race, let's say worst case scenario, then have to change their flights, then go to Devonport. Like, it's not that it's just impacting Abu Dhabi. It impacts everything else afterwards. And like, what is the, you know, best case scenario in that sense? Do we just try and take a chance and then like impact everyone along, get them to change their flight, stay a little bit longer? Maybe that was something that was possible, but from a common sense perspective and what we were dealing with at the time, i.e. taking a decision within 4.5 hours, like it wasn't that we could say, oh, we'll delay the decision and wait until Sunday. As soon as some of the athletes know they were out on Saturday and back to their training base, which I have no problem with because, I mean, under the circumstances, I would have done the same thing, right? But it would have been, no, you have to stay here, just wait, let's give us a little bit more time. And we couldn't have promised them that we were being able to deliver under the circumstances. So that was the implications there. It just had a domino effect that we couldn't control, and we knew that we had races afterwards that were still part of this qualification, and we can't then affect these races going forward that they don't have fields because people had to change their plans at the last minute.
Yep. Finally, you know, I've been to a number of these high pressure events and seen you under an amount of duress, whether it was, I'm thinking of like the storm in Chicago in 2016, right? Where everything got pushed forward. I'm thinking of, I didn't see you there last year, but I can imagine that there was a similar situation in Paris. Give us just some understanding, and I want the audience to have a little bit of empathy for you on this one. Like, you have to be on the phone from when your phone rang at 3:45. You must be talking until you go to bed 19 hours later. I mean, it just must never stop. What does it look like for you in the middle of managing a crisis like what you had to deal with in Abu Dhabi?
Yeah, look, first of all, not asking anyone to cry, I'm not going to cry myself a river here, but like that's my job. Like, there's a role to play here, and to be honest, like I'm like one step removed, let's say, from that fire when it's initially happening, because that's coming straight from a technical perspective to the TD, technical delegate on the ground, who's a volunteer and working as part of this organization to deliver an event as part of the criteria that we have to develop the sport, right? So it's not like paid people. So you're like having to manage that sit scenario, and this person is like in the fire, and you're like supporting them along the way because they have the right to be able to take decisions as part of the rules. So like, it's not like that you're coming in the side and you're just like, okay, get out of the way and we'll deal with this type of thing. You've done all the work for the last 9 months trying to prepare this race, and now we're just going to take over. Like, it doesn't happen like that. So first of all, it's like you have to balance it and you have to manage it, and it's very sensitive when it goes in those scenarios because there's so many stakeholders that are involved, and you have to be able to make sure that they're all taken care of. And that's why you have a contingency plan. That's why everybody signs off on a contingency plan document, crisis contingency plan document, that everyone agrees if this happens, this will happen. If this happens, this will happen. And unfortunately, in this circumstance, the government overrided all of that. And so we weren't even able to be able to, like, you know, work through this document that was in place for 9 months that everyone agreed on. And that's where it starts to like really go into a bit of chaos, because you're trying to manage the chaos because you're no longer working on this fantastic document that's been prepared and agreed by everyone. You're like floating over here trying to come up with ideas and like spitballing your whole way through it, which is not necessarily ideal because, as you know, everyone, including most of all the athletes, are like waiting for some sort of a reply so they can start to get their mind around about what they do and how they plan, if this race is going to happen, if it's not going to happen, so forth. So you're just running all the time to try to like make sure that you get clarity to be able to pass it along to the stakeholders as soon as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's just something that's crazy. It blows my mind, you know, thinking about the complexity of triathlon and we've seen these cancellations in other events. It just seems because we're all so close to this one, because of the timing of it, because everyone had to fly in for this one, right? It was a massive inconvenience. It seemed like it was a kickoff of a huge weekend of triathlon, and everybody was just kind of like, I can't believe, you know, Abu Dhabi was canceled. So I really appreciate you providing some clarity on that and some context. And, you know, I think
it wasn't just us too, right? You know, like obviously, like I'm speaking from an elite and Paralympic side of things, but there was nearly 2,000 age groupers and kids that got affected as well that didn't get to race. And of course, we were sitting in the breakfast on Sunday morning when they all should be out there racing, and you know, you knew it was packed out, and you knew why it was packed out, because people weren't meant to be in there, and even the hotels weren't prepared. They had to like open up separate rooms because, of course, they didn't realize that there were that many people in there, because, of course, people were there instead of out racing. So, you know, everybody was affected in that way, and nobody wanted it to be like that. But unfortunately, you know, like that's why we have that's why it's called force majeure. Like, it's completely out of our hands, and like we didn't want it to happen, but it happens.
What's so funny is, you know, in my business, being an agent, there's previous to COVID, there was always a force majeure in every contract, it seemed. Yeah. And you would look at it and be like, ah, there's nothing that'll really, that's that section, the force majeure section is something that everyone looks at and asks about now, where before you were like, I can't really picture an event where that would happen, where you would exercise force majeure. And now we all have a lot of experience in that. So
And it's like a unification of like the situation, right? Like, and it's not, you know, as I have kind of hinted before, like there will be more triathlons in this region. There will be more triathlons in other places, whether it's Dubai, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Oman, whatever the case may be. There's more triathlon events happening in this region. So like, we have to be prepared not to just think we can go to this region because it is and there's no rain, because that's not valid anymore. That's not a valid statement to make. Like, the contingency plan has to not only incorporate what it had, which was what we had in case of this matter would happen, but that the factors of the people that are taking these decisions need to be more involved as much as we possibly can, and not to even think that it won't come to that point, because it can, and it did. And so going forward, like, everybody can learn from this, even though it was such an unfortunate circumstance and we don't want it to ever happen again. Like, the due diligence process that needs to go in for all events, not just World Triathlon events, but for any event, we just need to consider this going forward for the sport.
Here's the reality. When I travel, I've been to all these crazy places. Last year alone, I went to Mexico, New Zealand, Japan, Italy, Czech Republic, you name it. But the reality is, when you're traveling globally, you can get sick. So yes, it's uncomfortable. I've thrown up. I've had traveler's diarrhea. I've needed help with an inhaler. These things happen when you travel. The problem is that, where am I going to get these meds, and how do I know what I'm getting if I... you know, I've got a situation where I've got to go to the toilet all the time. Luckily, when I've been traveling, what I have is I always have a little emergency pack with me. So I've got some high powered ibuprofens in case I get hurt. I've got the, you know, anti-diarrhea medication. Same thing with if I'm vomiting. These are things that I bring. And in the past, it's been, you know, a little bit of, I got to jump through some hoops. I got to go to my doctor. I got to say, hey, I'm traveling. This is what I have going on. TeleRx has created this solution that makes it so easy to get some of these medications that you may have to consult with your GP about. Now I can just talk to a doctor from the comfort of my home and computer. So, for instance, we're in Miami right now for the PTO race. I ordered these meds on Tuesday. They're at my door. I brought them here. So, if, you know, Kyle, for some reason, if I get sick today, I've got everything with me that I'll need to feel better. So best thing that you can do is go to telerx.com, check out what services you may have. They've got a ton of other stuff on there that I highly would recommend you check out and get to know. And if you're interested in purchasing something, please use code all caps PTN at checkout. For Kyle, we're not doing these dinky 5% off, 10% off. This is 20% off here.
Yeah.
So yeah, check it out. Let us know what you think.
I wanna change gears a little bit, and I wanna focus on the excitement of triathlon in 2024. So right now, and I want you to walk us through the ecosystem, we have the Ironman Pro Series, Super Tri, Challenge, World Triathlon, and the T100. Imagine that world when you were a professional. And I think just can you give some context of what it means as a former professional triathlete, like what that means for our current professional triathletes?
Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic time to be a triathlete, that's for sure. I don't think across all distances in many ways, and like, okay, there's a big focus on the long distance or the middle distance, let's say, but it's plugged a hole, let's say. So you can be in one side of the sport and be a little bit longer there, and then you can move to the other side of the sport and not have to make a huge jump now, because there's like something in the middle now that has some pretty good solid go forward, as we saw in the weekend. So I think it's exciting. I mean, at the end of the day, everybody that's out there knows that these people are private organizers and commercial entities, and they're coming with private equity money, and that money could be in something else in 2 years to time. So like, we need to make hay while the sun's shining, and we need to be, of course, nurture from our side. We need to be able to nurture the investment as much as we possibly can. Obviously, that's our role with the T100 to be able to, like, you know, I think PTR are doing a fantastic job. We did it with Super Tri as well with the eWorld Championships. They also did a fantastic job to create the arena games during COVID. It wasn't to like say, okay, now COVID's finished, that product goes to the bin. Like we respect that they invested their money there. So we wanted to continue to support that and continue to support the ideal, because who knows, it could happen again. And the same thing in the long distance mode is like we haven't been involved, let's say, World Triathlon at that level, because we've been, let's say, centrally focused in one area, but we have a little bit more openness and commercial mindedness to being strategic in our partnerships going forward. And there was an opportunity there. And of course, both sides needed each other. And so then we're able to sort of get into that space. So from, and even from an Ironman side, obviously, like from a triathlete perspective, obviously the fact that they started the series is fantastic, but I also think that the sport is still continuing to grow at that level. Age group numbers are going back to where they were. That's what we can see from the global participation surveys that we've been doing with our national federations. They're all starting to build back up since from the 2019 numbers. So like the sport is, let's say, in a good place. They just need to move forward from here. And of course, we need to be able to push everyone to make that happen in the way that we think is the best for developing the sport.
And with respect to, I'll call it like the, you know, the four or five leagues that we have out there right now, do you think that if we're looking at, you know, the Ironman, Super Tri, Challenge, the T100, and World Triathlon, so that's five major orgs of racing, is there a perfect number? Do you think that there's something that's realistic? Can we go up from there? Should we go down? Are we perfect? Like, what do you think?
I mean, obviously, like if I'm thinking like shooting for the stars, then we need to be able to have room for as many as we possibly can have, right? But we have, I think, a base of general athletes that can only manage a certain amount at the moment until the sport becomes, you know,
yep,
really, 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 really mainstream. But I think what is good at the moment is that like these organizations, even though on the surface sometimes they seem very far apart, in the back end, they're not so far apart. There are some things that need to be tidied up and, of course, need to be focused on, and whether it's rules or calendars, for example, as I can think off the top of my head for two obvious points. But that doesn't mean that nobody's doing that. It doesn't mean that, like, everybody's sitting there. Those organizations are all sitting there going, oh, I wonder who's going to take the lead on that. I wonder who's going to take the lead on that. Like, it's our role to take the lead on that, and we're trying to, like, bring everyone together to try to do that, and we're getting help from those private organizers who are helping us then engage with the other ones in a way which we weren't able to engage with them before. And that's the strength of the strategic partnerships, right? And I can be very, very frank in that and saying that our relationships with Ironman is much more stronger now with the relationship with the PTO, because we now have some general consensus to why we are investing more time in there, i.e. the rules, unification of the rules in the long distance side. Whereas before, when we were like back here, maybe they were like, well, what does it really matter to you? Why does it really, you know, what's the real context to you spending so much time and researching and committing some valuable time into putting, you know, ideas on the table? Well, here's the reason why we're doing it, because we think that this is the way it should be done. So it's like it brings everyone together in a different way without, like, let's say everybody coming in to have a kumbaya three times a year and then like not actually achieving everything. We kind of achieve the things first and then we come together and say, okay, what needs to be done to unify everything? And then we can have a kumbaya and we can come up with some real outcomes.
Yep. And then real quick, just because I know that there's a lot of confusion from the general audience, can you please explain and paint a picture for everyone how World Triathlon is the governing entity for all of triathlon? So the real simple one is you guys get to maintain or deem something a world championship. And there's these other entities that can't just say, hey, we're going to do a world championship unless they have your approval. Can you just walk us through that process right now?
Yeah. I mean, it's fairly, let's say it's pretty arbitrary in my comment to justify it as an answer, but the sporting world is set up by governing bodies that are particular in each national federation. And then the International Federation, you are a member of the International Federation, i.e. they are our members, not the other way around. Like we're there to support them, not the other way around in that sense. So like we want the national federations to populate themselves and do what they can and their thing. And we're just there to guide them and give them the education and the development tools to be able to do so. And it goes from the biggest ones to the smallest ones that are just setting up cones, mate, in their local event in Africa somewhere. So that's the framework of it. And then within that, of course, we have to be able to set the certain demographics of the sport, like the rules and the entries and the good governance and the anti-doping side of things in the sport for misconduct and all of these other things that are like safeguarding, all of these other things that like are now prevalent across the sport. It's our role as the International Federation to be able to provide these tools and setups for the National Federation to be able to use and then implement within their own countries. Hence, they're able to develop the sport in a way which is not necessarily just commercially related outside of the bounds of what we think is the best for developing the sport. And that's not to say that the private organizers are not developing the sport. There's not an argument amongst us or anyone, not only on this podcast, that will say that Ironman hasn't developed the sport of triathlon. That's not the question here. It's how can we develop the sport of triathlon in the future even better if we have a more closer collaboration? And that's what we have to work towards all the time.
The ecosystem.
Mm.
So the partnership with the PTO and the new T100 series, obviously you guys are, I'm looking at my clock, 8 months roughly into this deal. How has that been, like partnering with them? Was there similarities between what you guys did with Super Tri, formerly Super League, and how you guys maybe have learned something in the past from collaborating with them and what you applied to this?
Yeah, it is a little bit different in the sense that like it's not, let's say, a memorandum of understanding. So it's not an MOU. It's a commercial agreement. We obviously, because of that, we're contributing more human resource and more in the back. And like, we're in the back, like, don't get me wrong. Like, we're not in the front because we don't want to be in the front. The PTO have done a fantastic job doing what they're doing. And we have created a brand together called the T100. So whenever the T100 is mentioned, from our perspective, they're talking about us, but it doesn't need to be the World Triathlon T100 and the PTO T100. That's absolutely clear when we were talking about this. Like, everyone can associate the PTO and the T100 and just that side, and we can be behind the scenes. But from our perspective, the T100 is a brand from the collaboration of both entities. Now, what it actually is, and of course, it's not like you guys have spoken about before in Miami, where, you know, everything's on the ground is working. I used to take a quote from the last pod. you know, like where you said that the athlete experience of like having them on the ground and having them all in the same hotel and having them being in the going to the media thing and, you know, doing all those things, like that's like not, that's never happened before. And I fully agree with you, but that happens every single time in a championship series, right? It's just happening in a different way. So they're able to like take templates that we do and they're able to use it and then implement it as part of the process. And all those processes are behind the scenes. You won't see that from the entry process to the anti-doping process to the sport for misconduct process to all these things that we're like able to provide the energy and for, and of course to write the rules with them. And like that was difficult, right? Like you spent like that, most of that 8 months was spent doing that with Kat and Patrick and the people from PTO on the technical side and the technical committee from our side and our sport director and head of operations, like back and forth, weekly meetings, you know, like it took a lot of time, but in the end, they have a set of rules that like we believe is great for the sport and hopefully something that we can then propose to Ironman that we can see some mediation between creating a unification of rules and long distance triathlon. So these things are like happening in the backside more than like we'll be there in the front or our logo's at the event. Like, it's not necessarily the thing that's part of that this partnership is built on. It's built on, we really think it's fantastic what you're doing. We think it's great. We think it's fantastic for the athletes. We just want to make sure that we can do as much as we can to help you, to make it transparent, to make it good, to make it better, to give you constructive feedback after every single race. We've been doing this since 2009 and we have a fair idea of how it can be done, and you can take those things and you can move it forward. But it's not for us to control the event and to say what should be done in different ways or another. Like we're not there in that respect.
Yeah. There's rumors that we have heard about governing bodies and their involvement with the T100 as far as having to submit wild cards and things like that. Can you kind of shed a little bit of light on that? And I don't know if Pat wants to go a little bit deeper into those kinds of things, but
no, that's, you teed it up, Kyle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So I can answer from the straight point and not to have individual cases, but to give it, let's say from an outside look, well, I have a 17-year-old nephew that did the Continental Cup race in Napier. It was his first ever world triathlon event, and just like fizzing at the bone to just do all this thing. And at one point in time, he sent me a text message. He said, "Uncle Chris, I'm like, I'm going to do this race." And I said, "Fantastic." I said, "You need to get you need to tell your national federation, you need to tell Tri New Zealand that they have to enter you." Okay, I'll get mum to do it. So okay, mum did it. And then I got a text from mum, and mum said to me, we've got to do a health check, a PPE, and we've got to do an anti-doping educational course. And I'm like, and I said, yep, you got to do it. And the reason you got to do it is because if he wants to be a professional athlete and he wants to partake in these events and he wants to travel around the world and he wants to be transparent about all the things that he wants to do to be professional, then you got to do it. Like, in my opinion, like, regardless of my job, I just think that why wouldn't you do that? Like, it's not like out of the space of like that's a good thing for you to say that you've done to be able to A, look after yourself, check that you're okay, and B, do an anti-doping educational course to say that, look, I've done this course and I legitimately did it because I believe in this, in an anti-doping and safe sport. So he had to do it to get in this race. So for me, like, now we're talking about the best triathletes in long distance in the world. And some of them, let's say, had some issues personally to do it versus even worrying about whether the National Federation was involved, because it was like out of their time. They didn't have enough time to do it. And so for me, that's where it starts. It's a little bit like educational bias where they're coming into it late. They've been doing things in a different way. They've been outside, let's say, the high performance system that maybe, you know, most of the Olympic athletes or the ones that have been in that short course game are used to now, where they're used to dealing with the national federations all the time. It's not, you can end up with some like not necessarily perfect relationships above the board, even at Olympic distance, as you guys know. But it's not because the systems don't work. The systems work. And if you do them, you will be able to enter races and you'll be able to go wherever you want. And you might be able to receive funding if you're at a certain level. You might be able to get a trip paid for and a hotel paid for, whatever, based upon whatever the National Federation is deciding. But you have to be able to do that from the start to be able to get in that system. Once you've done it, you never have to do it again unless you have to renew it like in 2 or 3 years' time, right? So I think that's where the biggest hurdle was, is that Dylan was doing a ton of work to just explain to everyone, like, we're not trying to make this hard for you. We're trying to make you realize that everybody else in the world, including a 17-year-old kid that wants to be like you someday, is doing this. Don't make it difficult. Just do the process, and then you can go and race in Miami, and it won't be a problem at all. So yes, we tried to find some ways to help them out. We had somebody be able to perform some PPE tests in Miami for the ones, because it was a bit of a crunch and we didn't have much time, and we respected that. So we helped out a little bit on that. But everyone did their anti-doping course. I can categorically say that. Everyone that started on the start list in Miami did the education course, and everyone did a PPE. So everyone that raced there did exactly what they needed to race to do there. And if they had some issues with the National Federation, let's say from a political diplomatic perspective, they have to sort it out with the National Federation. Not because the National Federation is not going to be in good standing with them, or they're not in good standing with them. It's just because they just need to understand the process. And once they understand the process, it's not going to be something that gets in the way that they can compete in this series. There's not a single line in any little document, in any way of the rules, that can happen. It's just a case that there's process to be able to do that from a transparent perspective. And that's why there's rules. And that's why, from my perspective, and I know from Sam's side and from Chris Kermode's side, like, that's important for the series. Like, when you're talking about, Pat, like, big sponsors wanting to come along and sponsor the series, they want to know that stuff. They also want to know the numbers about how many people are watching this around the world and what space is available and can they have adverts on non-pay TV and all these things. But they also want to know, what does the athletes' agreement look like? What are these athletes signing? What is the liability of these athletes? Do we have, you know, 40 to 60 to 80 athletes that are committing to this series because they believe in it for the right reasons, not just because they got a contract and, you know, it's something to do now that they haven't got anything to do. Like, it's for the right reasons.
Yeah, Chris, what do you think it will look like, the relationship in the with respect to the T100 series of, and I'm thinking about an athlete like a Sam Long, right, who came into triathlon and has only ever touched the long course side and has now, for the first time in his career, interfacing with USA Triathlon at a, I guess, at a logistical level, right? What do you think that relationship looks like on the long, on the middle course side or the T100 side with the national federations in 1 year, 3 years, 5 years?
Yeah, I think like, that's why, like, Dylan's role, I said to Sam right from the start, maybe in September last year, I said, like, have you really defined Dylan's role? I'm like, Dylan is going to be the middle guy for a lot of things that when you start this process, is going to be like, he's going to be like answering a lot of questions. And this is what I think, to be honest, is like, they don't even, the direct relationship for the National Federation is something that they all should have. And if they can have it, fantastic. But they also can have somebody within the PTO and the T100 that's utilizing and facilitating that and helping them along that process. So then that can be Dylan or whoever it is. But it also can be someone from World Triathlon, which is what happened prior to Miami. Like, we were on the side working with the national federations to make sure that athletes were not, like, necessarily able to not enter the race because they hadn't fulfilled necessary requirements like a normal athlete, but that they would know that those requirements would be fulfilled before they started the race. And that's exactly what happened. Now, Dylan might need to play a little bit more of that game again on the way to Singapore, but I honestly see this just moving forward pretty quickly. And I don't see any, like, hang up from that side, because also there is an opportunity, and let's be fair, there's also opportunity for the national federations, not benefiting from the athlete relationship doing this, but then when we have these local events, like what we have in California, or like what we have in Ibiza, then the national federations are bringing the age group athletes to these races. That's good for the PTO. That's good for T100. That's good for World Triathlon. That's good for the athletes. It's good for the elite athletes, because there will be 2,000 to 3,000 age groupers at these events and not necessarily no one. So there's like a background to how can we get these people into the races and popularize these races. And one of those ways, of course, is working with the national federations, because they have the ability to talk to all those people exactly in the same way that I'm in.
And give us a scenario. This would just be your opinion of, when do you think, if you and I are running a national federation, what's our decision-making process to say, okay, now we're going to take resources and we're going to put it behind our T100 athletes, because we believe that will benefit our business of Triathlon Canada or Triathlon Australia or Triathlon New Zealand. Like, what do you think that decision-making process will look like as these federations are speaking internally?
Yeah, I think like that's our role, right? As I mentioned from the start. So that opportunity is there clearly, but that's also our role to make sure that we nurture the national federations as well. Like, not to make sure that like there's like any cannibalization going on and they find different ways, but they need to be able to formulate themselves. Again, we don't get involved in the domestic politics, let's say, but we need to be able to refine the working process around from an international side so that everybody still has the right and opportunity to be able to do these races. And that's why, like, from a perspective of like the entry process, like, it's not that the national federations will be like, as I mentioned, as I heard on a few other things, will be like subbing one athlete out for another or whatever. Like, it's really clear how these athletes will be selected based upon the rankings and the invitational process as part of the panel, and that these people from World Triathlon and people from the T100 and PTO that are selecting these, but not that the messages are coming through Dylan's phone or via Sam's email. Like, that's not transparency, and that's not where every other national federation, let's say, can feel like they belong to this and push it forward, because we're talking about, you know, the nucleus of the athletes that are racing the T100 or the ones that are contracted. What's to say that, like, you know, in some national federation say to Sam tomorrow, I want to host one of these. It's fantastic for Sam to be able to think that there's another city that wants to host this. And he can say, well, in 2027, you can. And we want to be able to build more events in Morocco, and we'll come there in 2027. Fantastic. Let's go there. But at the moment, he's got his staple ones, and we need to be able to look after them, and we need to be able to look after and furnish the relationships with those national federations.
Yeah. What did you think about the race in Miami, Chris? I know you weren't here, but.
Yeah. What I can say is that they're off to the races, let's say.
Their race didn't get canceled, right? They did it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I text Sam and I said, we're out, mate. You're up. No. So, I mean, obviously, like, it was, we always had talked to them, and like, as I think you described this already quite well, Pat, on the last pod, so I won't go into too much details, but it's from a perspective of how these races are run. There's like the races that PTO in the T100 and World Triathlon will run by themselves, and there's races that they will have other relationships with other private organizers, and there's ones that'll be another hybrid licensee type fashion from other investors. So there'll be different ways of like looking at it. And of course, this first one was clearly something that, as you can imagine, was a little bit like risk orientated, because they didn't have their hands over everything, because the hands were with other people in many ways. And so like a lot of the things that fell through the cracks to defend them were not because of them, but at the same time, they have to take the responsibility of that, as we have done in the past. And you just like, okay, then you learn from it and move on. And look, every single area that I know that from our team have already had constructive feedback and discussions with the T100 team, and said, okay, these are the things, you know, as I said before, we've been doing this since 2009, like broadcast side, we understand where the pitfalls are, but going forward to Singapore, how can you make this better? From a tech side, you know, if you dive in the water and the things are not waterproof, what are you supposed to do? Is it because the service provider told you different? We don't know. We need to find out. So like the due diligence of all those things, like somehow in many ways can get overlooked, because you're like scrambling to get to the start line and you're just hoping that it all turns out. The good thing that I can think that I can say from this, and I think that everyone agrees on, is that there was a race, and there were two really good races. And how the broadcast product will look like in the future, and the design of that 4 hours or so as a package, it's like 3 hours as a package, is still to be refined, and we'll have the whole year and more years to get after it. But for anyone to think that that's going to go bang and go straight like that is not giving these guys the credit they deserve to even get to this point as they are now. And I think like that's where like we just have to not like defend ourselves all the time. And I say ourselves because it was the message that I gave to Sam and the team, like no disrespect to one news outlet or one media entity out there, but like you don't have to defend yourself all the time. Like if they didn't hear the message that you're first year, first event, trying to get this off the ground, doing everything you can, then they weren't listening in the first place. Don't spend your time necessarily like trying to defend something that's clearly unjustifiable anyway, and wouldn't have happened in a million years if you didn't want it to happen. So I think going forward, like, that's the stronger message, is like, things will happen, mistakes will happen, we won't get it right all the time, but everybody wants to get it as good as we possibly can with every event that happens in 2024, with the idea that like there's a real good movement and going forward throughout the whole series, or the whole tour, should I say.
Yep.
Yeah.
When your workouts are hard, but you're not, get generic Viagra delivered discreetly to your door. TeleRx prioritizes your comfort and makes ordering prescriptions and meds a breeze. At less than 50 cents per pill, you won't find a better deal for generic Viagra or Cialis. No insurance hoops, no membership fees. Next day delivery is available on all orders placed before 2 p.m. EST. Please use code PTN at checkout for 20% off all products at TeleRx.com.
One last thing on the PTO World Triathlon partnership. This is just a personal thing. I love nothing more than 30 days out from a race being able to see a preliminary start list. Is that something that you foresee happening with the PTO in the future? Because I'm about ready to pull my hair out, because I'm like, okay, it's a week of the race, and I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, yeah, no, I can answer this two ways. One, the first way to answer it is like, I saw that you posted something that you already found out from a source that you already know about how many wildcards. I was like, well, that's interesting. Because the second way to answer it is, tomorrow we will have our call for deciding the invitations for the race in Singapore. So the fact that you already found that out was quite surprising for me, because I was thinking like, there's only 1, 2, 3, 4 people that could have come from.
Chris, that's why you came on our show, because we got the answers. We got the answers.
Oh, man. Classic.
Chris, yeah, Chris, so like, I will say, we have I will our say. Cool. I will say, you're not alone. Every organization that we've talked to in this ecosystem is always perplexed of how we get information. So it's just how the.
I think you cover yourself with your disclaimer to open your show. You know, somehow it could be fake news.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, no. But to be honest, guys, we have a call tomorrow to decide that between the panel. And the answer is simply yes, Kyle. That's what it will look like going forward. There's people on the wait list now. I'll be really honest. There's people on the wait list now that for sure won't get a start in Singapore, but they've done the process. They have looked at the rules. They've been given the information from the National Federation, and they're like, okay, should it roll down to 250th in the PTO rankings? If I'm not on the list, I can't race. So the message is going, it's getting out there, but it'll take some time that like outside of the contracted athletes and those ones then realizing they also have to do that, because then by them not doing that, we don't know how far down we have to keep going. So they also need to do that part of that process to be able to let everybody know if they're going to race or not going to race. And so it'll just take some time, but you're dealing with a bunch of people, or more importantly, two or three people on the panel from World Triathlon side that have been doing this for one of them has been doing it for 30 years. He's an expert. So he's passing this information, and Dylan is learning really fast and doing a really good job of trying to manage all this stuff, like I said, through his phone and email. And it'll eventually be a point where it'll just be like transparent, like all of the other start lists, and it'll be perfect. You'll know who's racing, when they're racing. And of course the list can change, as you know, prior to the race with dropouts or people deciding they can't race, but you'll have a better idea of who's going to go to which race going forward.
Chris, yeah. I have one last point on this, and I'm sorry. If I was working for a national federation, I could imagine that I might be bemoaning some of this extra work that I have to do for these middle distance athletes that I did not have to do before. Could you please speak to the importance of the work that they're doing for these athletes and why it matters?
Yeah, I think that also is an easy answer. The additional work they're doing is minimal to start off with, but there's no denying that they're doing something else. The other point is that it's very clear that, of course, this relationship has been prevalent for a period of time and is not like a surprise to anyone, and that there would be a situation where this would eventually happen. And we have been continually updating the every national federation with the information. So there's no surprises, let's say. And how that happens and goes forward, then it will work, and we'll find out how it works. But it's pretty clear that there's like no surprises in this sense. So all it is an educational process that, like, sometimes, and be very honest, sometimes you're sending all this information to someone, but it's someone else that's doing all of the entries, and that not this person that's receiving the email. So it's as simple as that. Sometimes it's not that they're not getting the information; it's just it didn't get to them. So we will have this scenario where it'll just take some time to roll out. But like we know on the other side from the championship series and the para triathlon and all the other levels of events that we have, the national federations know how to enter athletes. They know how to do this. It's not like they can't do it. Nobody doesn't know how to do this process. So it's more a total education on the middle distance, long distance side, help with Dylan, letting the contract athletes know what they have to do, and then a transparency of releasing these start lists in a way where everybody knows what they're doing, and the national federations will feel like they're totally aware of everything.
Yep. And for those listening, we've mentioned Dylan's name many times. This is Dylan McNeese, former professional triathlete, and he's really, I don't know his exact title, but he's become the athlete liaison for the T100 specific athletes. And I will tell you, Dylan does a ton of work. And I saw him at the race.
Thankless job.
But I mean, in the middle of all of this going on at Miami, I'd seen him because there was a bunch of people messaging me about the water bottle rule, because Magnus Ditlev had a water bottle down the middle of his suit, and I had walked out of where I was, and Dylan happened to be standing right there, and Dylan, cool as a cucumber, said, "He's all good with the water bottle. Don't sweat it." And I could kind of calm everybody down. So he's handling this job, which is probably incredibly stressful and never ends. He's handling it very, very well. So I do want to give a special shout out to Dylan McNeese.
Yeah, no, exactly. And like my job, and I told this to him on the phone yesterday, my job is to make his job easier, to be perfectly frank. Like, these processes that are in place that will eventually become like standardized and autonomized will mean that he's not like in the middle and like having to deal with this like lack of objectivity that he probably has at the moment. And we don't want them to be in that situation, because he's got many other important roles to play as part of the athletes board and part of the liaison and pushing the product forward. So that's like, that's again something that World Triathlon is like is taking on board, so that we can manage that part of the situation with the tour going forward, so it becomes easier for the ones on the ground from PTO to be able to deliver the T100 with the things that they need to do.
Yep, makes sense. All right, Chris, let's just focus on World Triathlon right now. Wave your magic wand. What does the series look like in 1 year, 5 years, 10 years?
Wow. I think that like it like if anybody can read between the lines, obviously like we as an organization, a non-profit organization, as the International Federation, of course, would like endless amounts of money to be able to invest in our product and in the sport. There's no denying that, right? We have to do it as parity across the board. So we can't just like, let's say, put a bunch of money into able body to not put a bunch of money into other areas in paratriathlon, for example. We also have to think about how that parity works across all of the other events that we have in our thing, whether it's winter triathlon or cross triathlon, everything. Like, it's all related towards a strategic plan. But the clarity from that side is that there's private investor money out there, and we need to be able to somehow be able to facilitate some of that into our areas as in any which way we can. And like, that's, shall we say, the new age of sponsorship. So yes, sponsorship is great, as you well know. It's difficult. It's a challenging market at the moment. It's maybe getting better in that sense. Like, we can get back out there and we've got more to show now because the numbers are going back up, but it's still difficult. But there's also this private equity side of things, investment that's coming in where people want a portion of something. And like, you can see that those like financial models of setting up events company is like becoming prevalent. And you only have to look at the PTO in that sense. So we are like thinking through strategic partnerships. How can that look like? How can we then be able to take some of that investment and be able to like pass it along the train, let's say? And if I just take an obvious thing, you know, like there's a lot of money being made and a lot of money being invested from a T100 side, you know, into the media side and content side, as you well know. But let's just take Magnus as an example. If Magnus was nobody, which he's not clearly, you have to invest X amount of money in him to make him a superstar. He makes himself a superstar from an athlete perspective, but what does that media content side look like? How can we help him furnish his image around the world to make him mainstream? Well, the PTO are doing that, right? Now, the new stars of this series, where are they coming from? It's pretty clear they're coming from the left. Some will come from the right, but they're coming from the Olympic distance, the super tri stuff. They're coming from this side. So if we can like invest there, just like let's say we take the Formula One side and we know all these like superstars that jump into the cockpits when people get injured now in Formula One, and all of a sudden you're like, who's Oliver Behrman? Well, you never knew who he was before, but you do know now because he's such a big piece in Formula Two that everybody knows before he gets there who he actually is. They don't have to make up something in 24 hours to find out who he is. And so in my opinion, that's where going forward the ecosystem will come even tighter, because some investment can be done on the left side to be able to improve the images and help us like furnish that, which has been something that we haven't been able to necessarily contribute a lot to because of the operating budget is going into different areas. And if we can find investment to do that, when it goes to the T100 side, I think it's pretty clear they won't have to invest as much because these people will already be stars, and then they can just furnish that relationship going forward rather than start from scratch and go forward. So like in that sense, that is one way, which I think is going to help both sides, because it's going to be there's going to be an ability to be able to say that we'll be able to help each other from an investment perspective rather than just saying,
yep,
we're just going to be there as a place where you go when you don't want to do Olympic distance anymore.
But the real world example is that you guys are putting a halo effect around a Beth Potter, a Hayden Wild, and that when they go up to the, well, when they go up sideways, whatever, to the T100 series, they are already a personality. They're already a celebrity, and it makes a lot of sense there.
Yeah.
I think like anyone that's, let's say, at both ends of the scale can see the benefit. If we talk about it from a national federation perspective, they will see the benefit from there. For mass participation, to have superstars in your sport, Ali and Johnny proved it when they did what they've done all the time in UK. There's always a kick-on effect. And if you take it from the other side, then like individual people that are related around the teams of these long-distance, middle-distance superstars, they're going to benefit from that too with the deals and everything that they're doing, and then the mass participation will come there as well. So it's a collection of like using this media strategy, which is what the PTO have never hid behind as not being part of why they're doing what they're doing, and like trying to find a way to implement it as a cloud across all areas of the sport. And Ironman will benefit too, and Super Trail will benefit too, but it needed to be something glued in the middle for it to be able to have a one to the point. At the point of time where we were, you know, 8 months back, I felt like it was left and right. But now my feeling is we've created a situation where we can now take everyone through this journey and invest in them all along.
Yeah. Sorry, just one big thing that we learned from the weekend in Miami is the opening up the media and the I'll just say the assets, the video and the photography, and allowing sponsors to use that free of charge with photo credit. We certainly saw this week was massive, right? It was everywhere. This is something that I've pleaded with Ironman to really change as well, and I'm going to plead with you right now too. What would be, is that a hard thing to say yes to?
No. I think you've been out of the game too long, Pat. We've been doing this
World
for like
Triathlon.
Years.
You can do it.
Okay, all right.
You can do it. Well, assets from everything.
Yeah. When you said this the other day, I didn't want to, like, obviously I was listening. I was like, okay. Oh, he doesn't know. Damn it. He could have, like, said something nice about it.
Sorry.
No. We pull assets.
This is directly from us. And Anthony already had the idea, and the guys already had the idea. They were doing it before, let's say. But we created a scenario where, and this is why it also has an effect not only from a media side, but where the national federations can also get these assets and be able to use these assets, which also means, of course, that the assets are now getting passed on. So the Danish Federation is also populating stuff with Magnus as well. So there's a flow-on effect even that Magnus is not even needs to know now, which just gets further and further wide. So that's... No.
I apologize.
It's not like that. And it's been done on a video side as well too, as well now. So we're doing it from video content this year as well. So we have the templates now. We use a platform called SmugMug, I think it's called. And then basically anyone just go in there, like you said, and just pull out a whole bunch of photos and then just go and use it. It's no problem. And then
the services
is monetizing. It's monetized. So like no hidden effects there, where everyone can just go in there and take what they want. And if they want to use it for commercial purposes, then they just have to ask and it's done. Easy.
It's genius. Yeah. That's fantastic. So again, World Triathlon leading the way there. So appreciate that.
Call the dogs off, Pat. Jeez.
No, man, I'll just keep it up. I'll just keep hitting Ironman with it. That's fine.
But like I said, Anthony and his team, they had a plan. Like it wasn't that they didn't have a plan. It was more a case of like taking that wider and like also including the national federations and then seeing how like from a monetized perspective, it could also pay back because of course anything that they can get back, they can just put straight back in. It's not to get back and pay the stakeholders. It's to put straight back into something else. So that's the mentality that we want them to have. And the guys have taken it on really well. And they've got a really good, of course, really thorough media team there and doing everything that they can to be able to keep up with all of the needs and wants. So they're doing a really great job and they're really good. Like the good thing is they're happy to listen. And I think like that's something that I've been like really happy with the relationship is that like our role is to educate and we are doing that, but sometimes it's hard if nobody wants to listen. And these guys are just really open. They're really sponges. They want to like know how we do things and we're able to tell them. And then if they can change it or manipulate it however they want to benefit them, then it's fantastic. It's just best practice and we know it works.
I say all the time, Sam Renouf in his next life will be a boxer because he can take punches better than anyone I know. So
that's good. Yeah. Chris, there's no secret that this is an Olympic year. And I'll be frank, this has been a challenge for you guys, I would say, this Olympic cycle. We've had, I believe, I could be wrong, but maybe one mixed team relay this Olympic cycle with just Sunderland happening. Obviously,
two.
Happened with Montreal and then the unfortunate circumstances with the water in Paris and then what happened this last weekend in Abu Dhabi. As far as Olympic qualifications go for these mixed team relays, like, how do you navigate the communications with like the Norway Federation or the Netherlands Federation that they're kind of on the outside looking in at this point?
Yeah, I think like obviously like you're 100% right. Super, super difficult and super unlucky. Like the mixed relay got a bit of a curse this last qualification period. At the same time, that's also like why you have robust rules around qualification. So like it's been like that from the start. We're not changing the rules after every year because we missed a race here and there. Like that's when it can get a little bit cloudy, right? If you start like messing around with things and start moving it. So like the feedback that we got from the committees, and we've had to go back to them every time from the moment, whether it was Montreal, what you said or even just last weekend from Abu Dhabi, the feedback from the committees was that don't add things, because if you add things, you're just going to overcomplicate things even more, and you're going to also open yourself for probably a couple of trips to gas. So if it stays where it is and it stays it is, then everybody, let's say, didn't necessarily have what they thought they were going to get in Abu Dhabi, but they had the opportunity, and nobody in Abu Dhabi got any opportunity, right? So like nobody could have foreseen that situation to happen, and the ones that went to Napier have in some ways benefited than the ones that didn't go to Napier, if you want to look at it just from the last 3 week cycle, let's say. But also the fact that Waltoco is still this last race, like it's always been. And some of those countries, should they choose to go there, if they were already choosing to go there, which I think if you look at the way the results are, there won't be anyone that wasn't going to go there that's now going to go there. I think all of those one were going to go there anyway. I don't think anything, let's say, will change other than what will the results be there. And that will then determine some pretty like...
And it's sandwiched between Yokohama and Cagliari.
It is. But if you think, again, if you think about, like I said, the national federations in some things, and I think you mentioned the Netherlands, so we could guess use them as an example. You know, in Tokyo, they had some people there that were just there for the relay. like they decided that they were going all in for the relay. They had some athletes there because they got athletes in the rank there, and they went all in the relay and they got fourth, and they were one spot away from getting a medal, right? So they were pretty close. Now, if you take that scenario, then that's what you do. The National Federation decides from a high performance perspective, they've got more opportunity to try to get a medal in the relay. Then they put all their eggs in that basket and they head off to Wauteko, and they don't necessarily fly their athletes around looking for individual spots to be able to get the mixed team relay on the other way. So everyone would have done the scenarios. Now the entries for Wauteko are obviously still open. They will continue to be open. The other thing you would have seen, I'm sure, is that we went out to every single race as soon as Abu Dhabi got cancelled and asked for everyone to increase the start list. So all the start lists have been increased, which means, of course, then we're sort of like adding to the opportunity that people are not going to get left off the list. That's not taking into consideration the quota, of course. But, of course, it's taking into consideration these athletes that are like single athletes trying to qualify their countries, or one athlete trying to get two spots for their countries, which could enable them to get a mixed team relay without even having to go to Wauteko.
Chris, you mentioned the quota. Is there, so last year, I think there was a scenario where there were six or seven women from Germany all ranked in the top 22. However, if all seven of them tried to nominate for a World Series race or a World Cup, only the top five would get in. Has there ever been any talk of saying, hey, if we'll ignore the quota if everyone's inside the top 40 or top 50? What does that look like? Because that keeps getting brought up, but I don't actually know the rigors that you guys are under to make that decision. So is that a possibility?
Yeah, I think like I couldn't answer the question other than to say anything can be on the table in that sense, and that only needs to be a recommendation from one of the committees, and then we have to take it seriously. Let's say it's not that we are not doing it ourselves as like operational staff, like considering it, but it's not for us to sort of propose to the committees that like, you need to be able to think about this. Like this has to come from them for us to then go and do the due diligence and the resource to see how it affects everything else going forward. And then to say, yes, you're right. Okay, now you need to recommend this to the executive board. And that's the good governance part, right? Like it's not us fishing out there for ideas and then all of a sudden, you know, like lobbying our ideas to the individual committees. Like it happens on some levels, don't get me wrong, but that's not the concept of the way that the organization works. It's coming from the committees. And I would say that that's something that could very well happen in terms of like conversation down that line. It's not the first time I've heard it. And so I wouldn't be surprised if that comes up. And of course, we've got a rules revision at the end of the year, which is part of the reason why this whole race ranger thing, why this whole unification of rules is happening, because this rules revision only happens every 2 years. So we only have the opportunity to, like, let's say, get a lot of energy in behind this now, because otherwise, if we did it every year, there would be no stability in the rules. And if we did it every 4 years, there wouldn't be any ability to adjust the rules. And so this time when we have to, like, get these proposals and start working through them and consider what they are.
I'm asking for my German friends. So which committee are they supposed to go to and recommend this?
Yeah, you need them to go to their athletes committee, and then you need their coaches to go to the coaches committee.
Beautiful. I will let the Germans know that.
Yeah.
And then, Chris, there was a claim made.
It's a luxury problem too, right? It's a luxury problem. Matthias Searle, the CEO over there, the Secretary General over there, who's a good friend. He, you know, 2 years ago he would have bit your arm off, mate, for that comment you just made then. So, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into that to get them to that point, you know, and then it becomes like a headache, which is ironic, right? But it's a luxury problem. For a national federation, of course, it's not ideal for the athletes, but like you know, it's just requires a lot of hard work to get there in the first place.
There was a claim made recently on a podcast. I don't know if you listened to that or not, but the claim
podcast.
Was
which podcast? That podcast,
the Triathlon Mockery podcast, that the prize money hasn't changed for World Triathlon WTCS races with inflation over the years.
That's true. Like I can't deny that. That's true. That the prize money at events hasn't changed, but then it did change in 2015, and then it did change again last year. And that all, again, came from the recommendation of the athletes. It didn't change to the top. It changed to the below. So yeah, the recommendation was the athletes was to spread it down. And then they also recommended that we take money away from the overall prize pool and we put it into the individual events more evenly. So there's more money from, let's say, I think it's like, let's say 11 down to 30th or 11 down to that, like that area in the races versus what it was for the 1 to 10 in the overall series. So there was like not necessarily an injection of money, but a more of a polarization of where the money was being put around based upon what the athletes are committing. And that doesn't answer the question in terms of like why there hasn't been. But I think like that answers the question in terms of that's not entirely factually correct to statement. But in 2019, before COVID, then this is the direction that we had when we had the last investment from the prize money going up, and then COVID happened. And then now we're let's say, regaining our composure. And as I mentioned before, looking at additional ways to be able to find ways to be able to get investment into the sport, and prize money will be able to come from that, i.e., the investment funds might not be putting directly into prize money, but if they're putting into other areas of our operating budget, then World Triathlon can then not have to put their money in that area, and then they can put a return in another area, which is what is part of the strategic plan. So it's going forward, of course, that is the goal within the strategic plan. There's a line within the strategic plan. It's clearly in there that we need to be able to increase the prize money percentage by percentage leading into 2025. So that's what we're trying to do now. We've recovered, trying to recover from of course, the COVID period.
Yeah. I got one more question regarding the federations and kind of, I don't know if this exists or not. So this is just like a leading question for you to say if there is or not. Is there an independent board that investigates as far as like federation powers and things like that? I don't know. It's been brought to light by, I guess, athletes in the past of, I would say, an unhealthy relationship with their federations.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that goes for anything, right? There's obviously the Athletes Committee, which is, of course, a body of athletes that have been elected by their corps as part of the Constitution, and they sit on an Athletes Committee, and they are there to be able to, like, facilitate any issue that any athlete may have. And on the second part, we have a tribunal. Now, the tribunal is an independent body that sits outside and deals with anything from safeguarding issues to independent professional issues like you just potentially mentioned there. They are there as a body which is not, they're outside of World Triathlon, so they're independent and objective, and they are full of lawyers, to be frank, and they are there to do a job to do that, so that we don't end up in a situation where we are like patrolling that as the International Federation, and the athlete doesn't feel like they're getting a fair go because we're in the middle or not in the middle enough or whatever it is. Like, this independent body will take care of those complaints or questions in a way. And you basically just have to contact them. And there's a free helpline and free email address on the website. And you can go there and you can send it. And I can tell you now, from knowing all of the tribunal members, that they are as busy as. And it's not because they're dealing with like bad stuff. They can be dealing with all types of stuff. But they are working because it works. Yeah. There is this facilitation to know that it works. Like, I can sit there and go, okay, well, these people are not just hanging around. Like, they're doing a job for us to be able to allow us to do the job. And if there's somebody that says to me something like this, it's not because I don't want to help them. Of course, I would love to help them. I can sit down and have a coffee and maybe we can sort it out. But it might not be the best thing for me to do for them. It might be just to pass them on to the tribunal, not because I don't want to help them, but because that's where they're going to get the best result if it's something that needs to be taken seriously in a way which has been set up to be able to facilitate so they can help them.
Yeah. Thanks for answering that. I know that's a hard question, so I appreciate that. The easiest question I got for you today, you ready? How's the water in Paris?
Do you know that there's a Netflix movie about a shark? I'm shitting you not. This, I don't, you need to research this. There's a Netflix movie about a shark swimming in the Seine during the Olympics and during the triathlon race, legitimately, that they are going to film in the next month before the Olympics happens. And it's like, you can search it online, you'll find it. And like, we've been like getting questions about this more than we've been getting questions about the water quality.
That was
like, is it actually real? Are you guys actually doing this? And I'm like, well, yeah, it actually is real, but we're not part of it. But it's quite interesting how someone's tried to like railroad this scenario. But all jokes aside, the water quality issue is of course prevalent and will continue. And at the moment, there's weekly calls with the IOC and with Paris 2024, which our head of communications is on, and she updates everyone on Slack and email after every single one to see what the thing is. But as we've maintained right from the start, like, we are only as good as the information that we have been given to us, and that's what we're using. And at the moment, like, we're in the same position, not that we're in the position of that the water is bad, but that we're in the position of receiving these results and seeing that the water is swimmable under our rules, and that's what we want to know. And we want to know more about why that is and how that is. And that's the questions that we're asking. We don't just want to know this is the result. We want to know, how did you get it? What are the measurements you're using? Where are you taking them from? We need to know all of those things, because we need that so that we can take those decisions, as we will have to when it comes time. And if we have that and we know that and we can trust it, then everything's going to be fine. They're pushing really hard. They're already like another like 5 or 6 kilometers down the Seine than where they were last year. You know how you saw those roadworks where they were doing all the digging on the side, because they're of course replacing all of the waterways there. So they're on target, let's say, to get past the point where they're meant to get to make it all go away. But of course they're pushing, you know. France is a union-led country, and they need everyone on their side to be able to keep moving forward. But that's the goal from Paris 2024.
Nice. Any I don't know if I should ask this question. Contingency plan, as far as potentially if you would have to move it to like Versailles or something to make sure that the Olympic triathlon still goes on?
Yeah, look, I can't answer that question. Not because I don't know, and not because I don't know if that would happen, but because the stakeholders need to sign off on the contingency plan, of which they will do. And when that is decided what those will be, then it will be absolutely clear and transparent what would happen if something needed to happen. And at no point in time will it be a scenario where everybody is throwing flour in the air wondering what's going to happen the day before the race.
Yeah, cool.
Hot takes, Kyle?
We could do hot takes, or I don't know if, Chris, are you interested in talking about 70.3 Geelong coming up this weekend?
Oh, I think 70.3 Geelong. Who do I know that's doing? Do I know anyone that's doing that?
Ellie Salthouse, sure. Grace Thack, Radka, Caulfield, Hannah Berry, Penny Slater, Hannah DeVette.
I had dinner with Hannah the other day. Actually, I had Harvey. It was dinner with Javier Gomez, Hannah DeVette, Annika Jenkins. Was quite the little dinner group.
Showstopper.
She sounded like she was on form. So I'll pick her to win, and then probably Hannah Berry to come second, and then Radka to come third.
There we go. Then on the men's race, you got Tom Bishop, Mike Phillips, Steve McKenna, Nicholas Free, Charlie Quinn. Quite a bit of Australian contingent here. So
okay. Charlie Quinn, Mike Phillips, and Steve McKenna.
All right, there we go.
Mark will be happy with my pace.
Yeah, there you go. There's also going to be a World Cup in Portugal, obviously, going on next weekend as well. Deep start list, it looks like. Vincent Louis on the start list, and I haven't really got to go too far down into it.
Continental Cup.
Okay, sorry. I still get this stuff confused.
Jeez, Kyle.
We give it to Chelsea. You give it to Chelsea, mate. Chelsea will sort it out.
Oh, yeah. Chelsea's talking about all the continental cups.
Exactly. She'll make a very logical argument for all of it, and she'll be very clear, and everyone will know that that's what needs to be understood. She's doing a great job.
There you go. I got one hot take for you, cool. And if you want to add more, we would love for you to add some hot takes. So... the one and only hot take I got for you, Chris, Who's winning the Olympics, men and women, and relay?
Oof. I don't even know if I'm allowed to say. Am I allowed to say stuff like that? I'm fired.
You could say. I mean, it's just a prediction of what you think will happen.
I'm going to say, maybe if I say countries, then I won't get in as much trouble.
There you go. That's what I would do if I was you.
Yeah.
Country I women, think, country men, and then country team relay.
Yeah. I think France men, Germany women, and I'm going to say British team.
Wow. All right. There you go.
And you need to ponder all that. You won't ponder your way through. What was he thinking?
That's great. Pat, you got a hot take?
I got nothing. I left it all out there in those questions. We had a big show last week. No, I think Chris, you came on and it was fantastic to have you on and answered a ton of questions and gave a ton of clarity to just kind of the rigors of the sport and the future of the sport and how exciting this year will be for everyone that's watching.
Yeah. No. And like I said, like it's maybe it's one of the less, it's not the most exciting part of everything that's going on in terms of that, but I still think it's like the skeleton of everything that has to move forward. So everyone's doing a great job out there, all the private organizers of the sport and so forth. And we just, you know, I just want to make sure that we do our best we can to find ways to work with all of them and collaborate with them. So then it can go better, man. And that's all that everybody wants. Like, you know, you guys are passionate about the sport for all the right reasons. And, you know, just because you're sitting behind a desk with a computer doing what seems like mindless things, it doesn't mean you're any less passionate. So, yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks, Chris. We appreciate you. And
awesome.
Thanks for coming on the podcast and spending time out of your busy Sunday afternoon to chat with us.
You're welcome, guys. Keep it up, eh? And we'll see you soon.